Amen. Thanks for that. So as you can see from the slides, we're in the book of Esther, but we're in the last half of the book, or the story. And a little bit of background, if you're visiting with us, I'll get these slides to advance. I did test it, and it did work. Oh, okay. We're going to get it adjusted. So in the book of Esther, but to kind of catch us up to where we are in historically, the nation of Israel came into the land through the leadership of Joshua and lived in the land led after the death of Joshua by men and one woman known as judges, are referred to as judges. And after a few hundred years, they began to long for a king, and God allowed them to have a king, in fact, several kings. But during the time of the kings, the people became disobedient and walked away from God. But God was patient with them throughout all of that time, for a long time. But eventually, his patience ran out, and he did allow the nation of Assyria to conquer the northern kingdom, and eventually Babylon conquered the entire region, and Babylon then became the dominant empire and conquered the nation of Judah in the south, and took the Israelites captive for a period of 70 years. And then after that 70 year period, the Medo-Persian Empire was now in place. They had conquered the Babylonians, and the Persian king, Cyrus, allowed the Jews to return home to rebuild the temple, and later on rebuild the city walls as well in Jerusalem. And so those are all the things that we read about and studied about in Ezra and Nehemiah. But just because some people were allowed to return home doesn't mean that they all did. So obviously when you live in an area for a number of decades, you grow accustomed and settled in that area, and you, I think our family is an example of that, who we moved to Virginia, we decided we weren't going to move again, so we settled here. And there are people throughout the region, Israelites throughout the region, who didn't come back to Jerusalem, didn't uproot themselves and their families, and they stayed. So, and the story of Esther that we can read about in the book is about some Jews who didn't go back to Jerusalem and stayed there. Two of which are one of the main characters in the book of Esther is Esther and Mordecai. Mordecai was the cousin of Esther. Esther was an orphan. She didn't have a mother and father. She was raised by Mordecai, who was about 15 years older than her. He looked after her. And they were in the city, the capital city of Susa. On the map above, you can see it's labeled as Shushan. It's kind of right there in the center. If you find the Persian Gulf and just go up, you see Shushan there. But Esther was a beautiful young woman. She was well regarded in that sense. She was described as beautiful and shapely. But there was a situation with the Medo-Persian king, Assyrius or Xerxes. I'll use the names interchangeably. Ahasuerus, Xerxes for me is easier to say. That's the Greek way to say the name of the king. And so I'll use Xerxes for the most part. but he had an angry, vengeful personality, and he ruled that way. And there's a situation at the beginning of Esther where he essentially had a 6-month military planning event. And then that military planning event, which was they were planning on how to deal with the Greeks, they were having to continually fight the Greeks, and the Greeks eventually overtook the Medo-Persian Empire. But they were doing the military planning kind of event for multiple months, and at the culmination of that event, they had a party that lasted 7 days. With a lot of drinking and revelry. And during that time, he requested that his queen, Queen Vashti, he was proud of, he wanted to show her off to his drunken friends and subordinates, and she refused to go and have herself be put on display. So that angered the king. There was ramifications from that. He essentially put her out, and she was no longer allowed to be king. And then the story kind of continues. And what you don't read about and what happens between the time that he puts Queen Vashti out and the search for a new queen happens is a battle or a war with the Greeks that didn't go so well. And so that happens during that time period. And he comes back and the king's associates' direct reports were trying to find a way to comfort him, settle him down, and so they said, "Hey, remember we were going to find you a queen? How about we put out a search and hold this empire-wide beauty contest? Select the most beautiful young women. We'll bring them together, and you can." Select your new queen from that group. And so that's what we did. That's what they did. Esther, being beautiful as she was pulled into that group. I can't imagine it was done willingly. It's hard. It doesn't say how, the state of mind that she was in, but it was pretty clear that these women were just pulled in. And brought in that way. Some may have wanted to, because obviously it was a chance to become queen of the largest empire that has ever been up to that point, and it would put you in a position where you would be extremely powerful if you were selected. But obviously, it's not an ideal situation to be part of a harem. Or a concubine for an angry, tyrannical emperor. And that's kind of what was happening there. And so she was very beautiful. Let's see, we catch up where my notes are. So he summons in all of the all of the women. Esther then is picked out very quickly as being special. Even the eunuchs who she was assigned to saw something special in her, and they spent a year getting ready for presentation to the king. They underwent beauty treatments. They used oils and makeup and other things. And there's a lot that went on during that 12 months. They were taught how to interact, carry themselves in the king's court. And who knows what else that they did during that 12-month period. But finally, at a certain point, when it was their time, they individually went before the king and spent a night with the king, and then the king had that initial exposure to the women, and out of that group, he selected Esther. And Esther was then chosen as the queen. So we continue on and in chapter 2, we talked about Vashti being put out. And then we get to a state where now Esther is now queen. And in the middle, towards the end of chapter 2, and it says the king was attracted to Esther more than any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. And so she got a royal crown on her head, and he made her queen instead of Vashti. And they had a great banquet. And then Esther's banquet for all the nobles and officials, he essentially created a national holiday through the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality. So it was a big deal for the king, and it just goes to show how impressive, how much of an impression Esther made on him, and how excited he was for to have found a new queen. So meanwhile, Mordecai is still very much around and very much looking after Esther. And he somehow had a role near the king's court, right outside the gate. And scripture doesn't say exactly what Mordecai was doing, but he had some kind of a position there that allowed him to have interaction with those close to the king. And he was known by those that worked there. It would be like somebody working at the White House that interacts with the senior cabinet of the president, something like that. But it was known that he was a Jew, but his relationship with Esther was not known at that time. They had kept that secret, and Mordecai had encouraged Esther to not reveal her true identity and her true nationality and ethnic origins, because I think Mordecai understood he understood there was anti-Semitism and there was hatred towards the Jews, and it wouldn't have worked out in her favor by revealing it at that time. So Mordecai, because he is close to it, he overhears two guards conspiring to kill the king. And so he makes this known to Esther, who then Esther relays that to the king. And the plot is thwarted, if you will. And what's important, the end of chapter 2, it's documented. So the Medo-Persian, the Persians, we know a lot about the Persian Empire because they were very meticulous with keeping records. They documented everything. And this is a situation where they documented the fact that Mordecai provided that tip that the king's life was in danger. So on into chapter 3. That we have King Xerxes honors Haman. It doesn't say exactly why or how, but we're introduced to Haman in chapter 3. Haman, it says, is the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and he elevates him to a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. So he essentially puts him as second in command of the entire empire, being above all the other nobles. But it's important to understand, and we see that Haman's described as an Agagite multiple times. I think for a very good reason. There's a history there between the Agagites or Amalekites. He's really, his ethnic background is an Amalekite, Agagite is the royal class, the royal family within the Amalekites. And so Haman was a direct descendant of that Agagite king that Saul was supposed to have killed but didn't. And there's a long history of the Amalekites being enemies of God's people and God wanting them to completely be wiped out. And that obviously didn't happen because there was still remnants, there was still descendants of the Amalekites. But God's will was for the Amalekites to be completely wiped out. And there was this hatred and animosity between God's people, the Jews, and the Amalekites. And so undoubtedly, Mordecai was aware of that history and that background, as well as Haman. He knew who he was and who he should be, or he felt he should be. And so I think that's just an important background and context to understand and be aware of going forward, because I think you'll see that animosity played out throughout the rest of the story. The king directed and places Haman in this position of honor, and he directs everyone else to bow down and pay homage to him. Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. I suspect it was likely due to the fact that he knew he was an Agite, and he knew he didn't deserve that honor, given the background and the historical background there. And so the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command day after day?" They spoke to him, but he refused to comply. So it sounded like he was urged to comply, but he didn't. And it says that he had told them that he was a Jew. So I think that was the reasoning that he gave for not paying homage to Haman, was because that he was a Jew. And that was pretty obvious that they were not Jews. We're not going to honor an Agite, or descendant of an Agite king. But that obviously made Haman, given Haman's personality, very angry. And he did not like the idea of Mordecai not paying him honor. And so because of Mordecai, he decided, I'm just going to figure out a way to commit genocide and kill all the Jews, because Mordecai angered me. And that's what he did. So he came up with a plan to approach the king and request that the king grant him the authority to kill all the Jews. And the rationale that he gives to King Xerxes is that there's a certain people being dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces in your kingdom who keep themselves separate, which is true. Their customs are different from those of all the other people, true. And they don't obey the king's laws. Not necessarily true. It's not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. Again, not true, but he presents it. He gives truths, and then he quickly kind of paints them as a people that would be disruptive and bothersome to the king, the king's empire, to the king's effort to maintain order and stability in this very vast kingdom that is huge geographically. That's composed of 127 individual provinces, from India to Pakistan, all the way over to Egypt, as you can see from the chart. So the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman's son. Haman's son of Hamadatha the Agite, and allows him essentially to issue the order with the ring. Then you could issue a decree or an edict, and it's as if the king himself had ordered it. And so it's like having a power of attorney to act on someone's behalf. So Haman essentially puts out an edict that allows all the enemies of the Jews to kill them. and provides financial incentive for them to do so. And he casts lots, and this is important, he casts lots in kind of a pagan way of casting lots, called pure, to determine when this was going to happen. And it was, by God's providence, it was put out months away, so they had months before this was going to happen. And couriers went out. They didn't have the internet, obviously, back then. They didn't publish it, send out, they didn't have a postal system. So what they did have, though, was scribes who were able to translate the order in all the various languages, and horsemen who would then take it and travel to all the horsemen would take the edicts and send them out throughout the region and post them in public spaces and essentially get the word out. And so that's what happens. And it says, then the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered. And so it was this king, obviously, again, is irrational and erratic and not in control and allowing others to run things that don't have proper motives. And it was a difficult situation, obviously, for everybody in the region, and especially the Jews at this time. So Mordecai then, is because he's still in contact with Esther, works to he learns that what had been done, and he was in mourning, and he tore his clothes, and he was wailing. But he could only go as far as the king's gate because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter. So Esther hears about what was going on with Mordecai, inquires about it. And then there's eunuchs that are used as kind of messengers back and forth to communicate between Mordecai and Esther. And he comes to find out, Esther comes to find out what the plan was. Obviously disturbing and saddens her. But Mordecai and then encourages her to approach the king and request that something be done about it. And she's obviously nervous about that because the situation when you approach the king and the king doesn't accept you, he doesn't put out his scepter to essentially allowing you to approach him, the penalty of that is death. So if the king's in a bad mood one day and you don't realize it and you approach him, it's the end of your life. And so it was a very risky proposition that Mordecai was asking Esther to undertake in an effort to save the Jewish people. So what was Esther's response then to that Mordecai's request? What's that? Yeah. Well, she asked for fasting, and it's implied that prayer kind of goes along with it. And I think it's important to understand that God is not mentioned throughout the book of Esther at any point, but God is the main character in Esther, and His work and His hand can be seen throughout the entire book. And so Esther does request that that fasting and that the minds and the hearts of the Jewish people kind of support her in as she prepares herself to approach the king. She says, "Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day, and I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish. So be it." She was prepared. She was prepared to die. She knew what she was getting into. And she very bravely knew and approached the king and prepared herself to do so and to undertake that risk. So on the third day, Esther put on her royal robes. She stood in the inner court of the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in court, he was very pleased with her, and he held out his gold scepter in his hand. And so Esther was able to approach the king. And the king asked, "What is it, Queen Esther? What's your request? Even up to half the kingdom." So Esther then replied to the king. And she asked that the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet that she's prepared for him. Kings said, "Sure, let's do that. Let's bring Haman at once." So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared, and as they were drinking wine, the king then asked Esther, "Well, now what's your petition?" I think his curiosity was growing. He wants to know what it is she actually wants. And what was her reply? It was, "Well, how about my request is this? If you regard me with favor and it pleases you, fulfill my request and let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet, and I'll prepare for them, and then I will answer the king's question." So her response is like, "Hey, we're just going to have another banquet. We'll come back tomorrow, and then I'll let you know what it is I actually want." So Haman's very happy about this. He thinks really highly of himself. He leaves. He's going home again, though. He comes across Mordecai as he was leaving, and Mordecai doesn't bow to him, and that really burns him up. He goes home to his friends and his wife, Zeresh. He boasts about his wealth and his sons and all the ways the kings have honored him. And then he talks about being invited back, only with, just meeting the king and Esther, and is very, very proud of himself. But he is complaining about Mordecai. See, he calls him the Jew Mordecai, sitting at the king's gate. And so his wife then suggests, "Hey, how about you just build a gallows, have a pole set up at the height of 50 cubits, which is 75 feet. And we'll have Mordecai impaled on it. And then you can go with the king to the banquet and enjoy yourself." And so that's into chapter 5. And that's where we pick up with our study in chapter 6. And that's when now it starts to get really good at this point. In chapter 6, things start to really pick up. And so that night, the king couldn't sleep. And so there's all kinds of things you could do when you can't sleep. He chooses, kind of providentially, to have the books of the Chronicles brought to him. And it turns out it was the exact section that talks about Mordecai and his plot that he uncovered of the two guards who were attempting to kill the king. And so the king asks his attendant, "What honor and recognition has Mordecai received for this?" And they give him the answer. It's nothing was ever done for Mordecai. He was never given anything, as he should have by custom at the time. And so the king then asks, "Who's in the court?" Then of course, it's Haman in the court, because he had showed up there very beginning of the morning to ask the king if he could go ahead and impale Mordecai. And so it just so happens he was the one there. And so the king asks Haman, "Well, what should I do if there's someone that I really want to honor and I really want to give honor to?" And Haman, being the person that he was, assumed that the king obviously wanted to honor him. Who else would he be talking about? Excuse me. And so he gives a response, and his response is great, because it's essentially put on the king's robes that the king has worn, get the king's horse that has the crest on the top of his head, and have a senior noble parade him around, declaring that this is somebody we want to honor, that is this is how those that the king wants to honor are treated. And so the significance of the horse the king's horse in that way is essentially the same thing as the king's throne. It's just a mobile throne. And so having the king's robes on and being sitting on the king's throne and being honored in this way essentially puts you as close to being the king as you could be without actually being the king. And so that's what Haman, that's where Haman's heart was. I mean, that's what he desired. And that's what he expected would happen to him. But he comes to find out that the king essentially orders Haman to go honor and do what he just described to Mordecai. And so that's what he does. So Haman got the robe and the horse, and he robed Mordecai and led him horseback through the city streets, proclaiming before him, "This is what is done for the man that the king delights to honor." And afterward, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, which I love. So this great thing happened to Mordecai. And what does Mordecai do? He goes right back to his job at the gate, and doing what he was doing. And what he was supposed to be doing. He knew what that event, you know, it's no indication that it fazed him or changed him in any way. But Haman then, it did affect Haman. He rushes home, his head covered in grief, and he tells his wife and all his friends, and his wife, it seems like she sees him for what he is and the situation for what it is. And he advises and provides him some counsel. And she says, "Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin." And so while at that same exact time, the eunuchs did show up and they take him away to the banquet that Esther had prepared And they're on into chapter 7. So there's evidence that we see of the providence and timing of God in chapter 6. I mean, just the mere fact that the night before the second banquet, King Xerxes or Ahasuerus has insomnia and he can't sleep. He reads the chronicles about Mordecai's loyalty. It just happens to be Mordecai. He reads about everything he could have read. Haman showing up at that exact time in the morning to provide the response to the king. It could have been any other nobles, any other the royalty could have been in there at that time. It just happened to be Haman, and he happened to be the only one. Ahasuerus' riddle-like question to Haman, he asked it in such a way that didn't let Haman know that it wouldn't be about him. That was very providential. Mordecai being in the mind of both men, though they don't say so. And Haman's assumption that he himself is the man deserving of honor. All of these things, really, it's you could say it was coincidence lining up, but it's hard to line that up. I mean, it's hard for all that to happen in the way that it did. The hand of God is clearly seen here to make all of this happen. So there's things that we can observe about and take away from this chapter for us and what it teaches about us and our own lives. So where do we see truth in Esther chapter 6 that we can apply to our lives? Yeah, that's right. We definitely we see that God is in control. Only God could have orchestrated the events in this way, and we see that in some of the statements from Mordecai back in chapter 4, Mordecai understood that God's will was going to be done, and God's promise, he was aware of God's promises to his people, and that he could be a part of that and be used by God, and Esther could be used by God to bring about God's will, but no matter what, God's will was going to be done, and it would be brought about, and you could be a part of that or not, but it was going to happen. And we should have faith. It should give us comfort in knowing that God's promises are true. They are going to happen. Everything we've been promised by God, we can count on. And we can find comfort in that, in knowing that those promises are true and will come and be fulfilled. No, that's great observations, great points there. Prayer and fasting undoubtedly had a role here, although it's not explicitly, that linkage isn't specifically called out. Just as God isn't specifically called out, God is there and working to orchestrate these events, and he is hearing their prayers and knows of their suffering that they underwent during their fasts. There's no doubt about it. And so the second, on in chapter 7, we see Haman ends up getting killed instead of Mordecai. That's a quick way to describe it. But the king brings in Haman and Esther at the banquet, and they're drinking wine. And then the queen finally answers the king's petition to tell him what it is that she wants. And she answers that, and very astutely, if I found favor with you, your majesty, if it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. And so she now identifies herself, associates herself with the Jewish people, lets the king know of the plan, of what was going to happen, and that, that there was someone responsible for this decree that all her people would be killed and annihilated and destroyed. And then she essentially outs Haman as the adversary enemy and calls him this vile Haman. And Haman obviously was terrified. He immediately knew that this was not going to end well for him. The king goes out into the courtyard. I think it's kind of implied the king went to go get the guys that were going to take care of Haman. And so Haman is doing everything he can to plead with Queen Esther while the king is stepped away for a second. The king comes back in and sees Haman kind of laid over on Esther and assumes that he's trying, again, he's such evil and vile, he's also trying to sexually assault her or do something inappropriate. And at that point, then, that's all, it's over, it's done for Haman. They put a hood over his head the king is then reminded by Harbona, one of the eunuchs. Again, I love the eunuchs here in this story because they're kind of like wallpaper. They're always there and they're always doing something, kind of orchestrating, making things work and happen in the background. But you see the eunuchs there given the idea of, hey, there's already this pole erected. Why don't you just use that? And so the king was like, yes, impale him on it. And that finally, it calms the king down. It says the king's fury subsided. But that same day then, King Xerxes gives to Queen Esther the estate of Haman. And Mordecai came into the presence of the king, because Esther, it says, this is when Esther lets the king know the relationship that she has with Mordecai, and now there seems to be kind of a closeness and a bond there. And so Mordecai is given the signet ring of the king. But there's still this decree that was put out by Haman that means that all the Jews were going to be killed and destroyed. And so there was a rule there. If the king puts out an edict, it can't be reversed. It doesn't make sense to me why they would make a rule that says that. I mean, if you can make a rule, if you're the king and you can have all the power, you can make a rule that says you can reverse your own rules. But they didn't. That's not how it worked. And so they couldn't reverse the decree that Haman had already put out. So this it was still out there. It was still going to happen. So they had to figure out a way to deal with it. And so that's what the petition that Esther makes to the king. Please help me reverse your decree. And the king says, well, here's what you can do. You have my signet ring. You can create your own edict to deal with it as best you see fit. And that's what they do. They very Mordecai very meticulously works with the secretaries to write out a new edict that essentially says all the Jews are allowed to preemptively defend themselves prior to the date set for their annihilation in the previous edict. And so there was much rejoicing throughout the land. All 127 provinces get the edict. It's translated in all the different languages. And that goes out. And essentially it's a plan for the Jews to be able to defend themselves and to thwart their destruction. Mordecai then is, again, this kind of puts Mordecai on this path, a rising path, if you will, where he's now wearing royal robes. He's got a position of prominence. He's replaced Haman. Replaced Haman, and he's got as much power as Haman ever had, except he also has respect and fear from the people and the rest of the rulers throughout the empire. And so he's becoming extremely powerful, and he continues to have more power as kind of the time progresses through the rest of the story. And so on into chapter 9, we've got the situation with the enemies of the Jews. We see it playing out, and there's a body count. Doesn't talk about if there any Jews were actually killed, but it does give an account of enemies of the Jews that are taken out. And it gives a number of those killed in the citadel of Susa. And the king said to the queen, Esther, the Jews have been killed and destroyed 500 men and 10 sons of Haman in the capital city of Susa. So actually, kind of an important point is that Haman's sons were killed, all 10 of them. And so it's effectively taking out the last remnants of the Amalekites, those enemies of God that God wanted destroyed thousands of years or 1,000 years ago prior to that. But the king asked Queen Esther, if it pleases the king, Esther's response is, it pleases the king, give the Jews in Susa permission to carry out this day's edict tomorrow. So he's just asking for legal authority to continue the battle for one more day, because they astutely knew that they needed another day to finish the job. And she asked, let Haman's 10 sons be impaled on poles. And I think the sons were already killed. This was a kind of a show. It was culturally, it's one of the ways to show and to that their destruction was put on a public display. There would be no doubt that they were destroyed. It likely provided some sense of peace and reassurance to the Jews that the promises that God had made, the request that God had made, has finally been fulfilled. And that ends up resulting in what's known now as the Festival of Purim. It's named after that casting of lots, the casting of lots described earlier in the chapter. Mordecai and Esther write letters establishing that this festival will forever be observed, where they recognize the end of the fighting and the relief they got from their enemies unfolded here towards the end. And so that Festival of Purim is still celebrated by Jews today, where they remember Mordecai and Esther and what they have done and how God had shown them grace and delivered them. And so Esther is really a story of deliverance. And we see God again delivering his people, saving them, setting them up, and bringing about his plan to allow the conditions to exist where Jesus could be born and come to the earth. And so that's where we stop today. Thanks.